Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 12th of November 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live at radioalbion.com tonight because we do like to have a few live shows at the website and Friday night is traditionally the night for one of those, so you're welcome to join us in the chat room. If you're listening to this on the downloads, then yeah, do check. Drop by the chat room at 8 o'clock on a Friday night and you can always ask questions or interact with us while we're actually doing the live show. And of course, I have with me today the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm well, thanks. Good to be here.
Excellent, excellent. I'm glad to have you here. And we're going to be getting into a completely new subject tonight as well. We've sort of finished with Egypt. We've finished with Alexander the Great. And what I'd like to get into today is China and that area. And most people will be thinking, well, I didn't know there was very much white history in China. So I suspect you might well be surprised by some of the subjects that we're going to be bringing up tonight. Were you aware of white history in China, Patriarch?
I'd heard of some of the mummies that were found, which we're going to talk about, which, you know, connected our DNA to that region, but I don't know the details of it all, really.
Yeah, there's also there's the Buddha as well. There's the dolmens that we will be getting into, and I'm still learning about this myself as well. I've got a book here called The Mummies of Urumqi: Did Europeans Migrate to China 4,000 Years Ago? And I think Europeans were definitely in China, but they weren't Europeans. I mean, as we've been showing so far in this series, there were white people in the Fertile Crescent, there were white people in the Near East, and they spread out from there into Europe and into the Far East and bring in civilization with them. So it's not strictly correct to say that it was Europeans migrating to China. I think it was just white people because we've migrated all over the world. But we'll get into the details of that as we go along. And I think most of the notes that I've got here, or the sort of outline that I've got here on this bit, is actually from Wikipedia. This is quite well-known information, and there are television documentaries on this as well. We also headed east from the Fertile Crescent on what is now known as the Silk Road, although what we're talking about today, it was before the Silk Road actually took place. And the earliest remains that we actually find of us there are in the Tarim Basin near China. And it's actually, it's about two-thirds of the way from Mesopotamia to Beijing, is where the Tarim Basin is, and it's above Tibet. So you've also got Tibet nearby, and you've also got the Hindu Kush Mountains nearby, which I thought was particularly interesting, obviously because it's named after Kush again. And we've mentioned Kush before. In fact, we'll end up looking at Kush closer when we look at Ethiopia. But just so we can get an idea of where this place is, this Tarim Basin, and it's desert now, but it wasn't desert back then. And the Tarim mummies are a series of mummies that were discovered in the Tarim Basin in present-day Xinjiang, China, which date from 1800 BC to the first centuries BC. So you're talking 4,000 years old. And there's two different types of mummy there. And the oldest mummy that's 4,000 years old, that's quite clearly white. The mummies, particularly the early ones, are frequently associated with the presence of the Indo-European Tocharian languages in the Tarim Basin. And they actually think that the Tocharian language came there later on. They're not certain that these Indo-European bodies that they have found there actually spoke Tocharian, because we only have evidence of that being written down from about 1,000 years later, 1,500 years later.
Okay. Is there any significance about the Tocharian language, do we know?
Well, we know that the Tocharians were European, and because we've got images that were drawn of them, we've got paintings of them in China handing over donations to the Buddhists. I mean, that's from about 1000 AD. So we're talking a lot further in history, or a lot closer to us in history, when they were speaking Tok'arian. So we don't know what these original Aryan bodies that we found there, these Aryans, we're not quite sure what language they spoke. It may have been closer to a Celtic language, surprisingly enough, because of the clothing that they were wearing. They were wearing plaid, which is what the Scots still wear today. And the textiles that they had were the same that the Celts had, that they had in Gaul as well. So just going by the clothing that they had, they may well have, the language they spoke may well have been closer to the original language that the Gauls spoke, and Gaelic as well, and the Galatians, the book of the Galatians.
Yeah. It makes sense, wouldn't it, to tie cultural influences together?
Yeah, and that's just stuff that I've been revising on today from this book, The Mummies of Urumqi. And there's another fantastic bit as well, which, as I was just talking to you about before we started, which I just looked up because I knew I remembered something about it. They also found the world's oldest cheese there as well. And you may think, well, what's so fascinating about cheese? Isn't it just curdled butter? Well, you actually have to put a different chemical with it. I think it's called rennet, something like that. And it's quite a technological process to actually turn it into cheese. And you have to be of a, quite highly technologically proficient in food technology in order to actually make cheese. And this cheese was there. And I guess that shows that they weren't lactose intolerant either. Another trait that we have as Europeans.
True. Yeah.
Victor H. Mayer, the American sinologist's team, concluded that the mummies found there are Caucasoid and likely speakers of Indo-European languages such as the Tok'arian. So they're saying that they spoke Indo-European. Wikipedia seems to want us to think that they spoke Tok'arian for some reason. But what he's actually saying there is just likely speakers of Indo-European languages such as Tok'arian. The earliest Tarim mummies found at Quirigul and dated to 1800 BC are of a Caucasian physical type whose closest affiliation is to the Bronze Age populations of southern Siberia, Kazakhstan, Central Asia and the Lower Volga. And of course, Kazakhstan now has non-whites in it, but so does this Tarim Basin. But back then, it was white people that were in Kazakhstan, obviously in the Lower Volga, the Ukrainians. Also, the Hallstatt culture in Austria has a link with them as well. They were wearing the same clothes as well that these Caucasians were that were in the Tarim Basin. Notable mummies are the tall, red-haired Chechen man, and I'm always looking at that thinking it says Chechen man, but it's actually Chechen man, or the David, as he is called, from 1000 BC, and his son, also from the same time, who is a small one-year-old baby with brown hair protruding from under a red and blue felt cap with two stones positioned over its eyes. The Hami mummy, which is 1400 BC, a red-headed beauty found in Quetzalcoatl and the witches of Subeshi, 4th or 3rd century BC, who wore 2-foot-long black felt conical hats with a flat brim. Also found at Subeshi was a man with traces of a surgical operation on his abdomen, and the incision is sewn up with sutures made of horsehair. So they were very advanced there, aren't they? If they're, you know, cutting people open and then sewing them back up again. You don't really imagine that they would have been able to do that then because of the, you know, you would think that would get bacteria in it, wouldn't you? Doing it with horsehair.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's one thing to cut people open and you know, stitch them back up. Whether they survive is a different matter, but I'm assuming they would have done. Well, if they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, they may have had some kind of antibiotic that they were using, some natural antibiotic. The oldest woman there is actually known as the Beauty of Lulan, and she's got red hair, and she's wearing a felt cap with a feather in it. And if you look at a picture of her, I will actually put the picture of her with the podcast, and it wouldn't be out of place today to see somebody wearing it. The men there were wearing trousers, I think it's the first example that we actually have of men wearing trousers and a tunic. So they're wearing the same clothes that we're actually wearing now. And also some of the clothing that they were wearing, I forget what type of textile it was, but they also had it in Crete. We can see it depicted in Crete when we were talking about Minoan Crete and the clothes that they wore there. So this was a technology that spread across the white world, basically.
That's interesting. I always thought that it was kind of the Scythian cultures that started introducing trousers, mostly because they were horseback riders, and it was easier for them to ride, basically.
Well, it does imply that they were riding horses, and this is a similar area. I mean, the Scythians headed in this same direction. They also headed off to the east, but right. I think that was a little bit later on, because we're talking 2000 BC here, and I think you get the Scythians around about 1000 BC and onwards.
So maybe the Scythians popularized it, whereas these introduced it.
Yeah, or maybe we've got more evidence of the Scythians than evidence of the others wearing it, because when you're talking about the actual clothing itself, unless you've got images of it, you're very, very unlikely to find examples of the clothing, because it's going to rot. And why they didn't rot here is because it's all salt. It's a desert, but it's all salt flats. So when they buried the bodies, it extracted all the moisture and preserved them. And that's why they've been preserved for so long, rather than doing a process that they invented themselves, like the Egyptians did. It was a completely natural process, and it preserved the clothes. And they had a way of felting as well, like their clothes were made out of felt. And they still do things in a similar way the Mongolian herdsmen do today. So they must have, the natives in the area must have picked up what these white people were doing and started doing it for themselves as well, I think. Mm. But yeah, okay, comparing these sutures made of horsehair, it's that's probably up to a similar medical standard as the Egyptians, who were making new teeth and wiring people's teeth in with gold wire, weren't they? Making bridges, dental implants.
Yeah, it's definitely up there. I wonder if they were if they kind of shared knowledge at that time. I mean, they would have branched off and went on their own path, spreading outwards, but I wonder if information would have traveled and they'd been able to exchange, knowledge and wisdom and, medicines and things like that.
Well, you should imagine the explorers would have done, because they wouldn't have wanted to get on the bad side of the people that they were passing through, because they wouldn't have had a big army with them. They would have been traveling looking for resources, looking for metals, or looking for salt, looking for land to put their animals on, that sort of thing. So they might well have shared their technology with the peoples that they came across. I think that is the theory, that technology just spread like that. But I think civilization could really have only been spread by the people that were able to maintain it and create it in the first place. Once the people that live in an area cease to be of that people type that created the civilization, that the civilization falls apart because they're not able to maintain it.
Yeah, it might sustain itself from the momentum, of the people, and it'll be a slow process, wouldn't it, of dying off. And I guess it would correlate with the rate at which the whites absorb themselves into other populations and genomes.
Yeah, I think we could see that in Egypt, couldn't we? I mean, after Egypt's peak, when it became multicultural, it never achieved any more great heights, and it was on the way down when Alexander the Great took over and reinvigorated it. I think, yeah, it depends on how high the IQ is of the people that have been mixing, I think. If it's very low, then the civilization is going to collapse pretty quick. If it's still fairly high, then they're going to be able to maintain it. Well, many of the mummies have been found in very good condition owing to the dryness of the desert and the desiccation it produced in the corpses. The mummies share many typical Caucasian body features, tall stature, high cheekbones, deep-set eyes, and many of them have their hair physically intact, ranging in colour from blonde to red to deep brown, and generally long, curly, and braided. Their costumes and especially textiles may indicate a common origin with Indo-European Neolithic clothing techniques, or a common low-level textile technology. Chechen man wore a red twill tunic and tartan leggings. Textile expert Elizabeth Wayland Barber, whose book I have here, who examined the tartan-style cloth, discusses similarities between it and fragments recovered from salt mines associated with the Hallstatt culture in Austria. It has been asserted that the textiles found with the mummies are of an early European textile type, based on close similarities to fragmentary textiles found in salt mines in Austria, dating from the 2nd millennium BC. And I've got a quote here from her book where she's actually talking about the Celts. And she thinks they sort of stayed there in Europe, but I think they came in from the Near East, basically. But let me just read this this bit about what she says about the Celts. The Celts did not originate in Britain, but began to reach the British Isles only in the 4th century BC as they fanned out rather abruptly from Central Europe. Some of their tribes had already overrun northern Italy, breaking Etruscan power there and sacking Rome in 390 BC. And that was actually one of our British kings, Brennus and Belinus, in the Greatest Britain series that we have here at Radio Albion. If you look up Brennus and Belinus, it tells you the story of that battle, and it was a British king fighting with the Gauls, fighting with the Celts, and they sacked Rome. Others advanced down the Danube River, terrorizing the northern Balkans. These were not the small, dark-haired, white-skinned people we associate with Ireland and Brittany today. Rather, they were huge blonde warriors with pale blue-grey eyes and prominent noses, to go by the descriptions and sculptures left by the Greeks and Romans. Fierce as they were large, the Celts soon conquered today's northern Italy and France. Julius Caesar's Gallia, or Gaul, so named after a Celtic group, then northern Spain, Belgium, named after another Celtic tribe, and Britain, likewise a Celtic name. Much of Caesar's fame and power in the 1st century BC came from subduing Gaul and southern Britain and annexing them to the Roman Empire. He was crossing the river Rubicon, the boundary between Roman Italy and the north Italian provinces of Gaul, when he uttered the famous statement, "The die is cast." Caesar opened his noted account of these campaigns with the words that every student of Latin learns, "All Gaul is divided into three parts." The Celts, or Gauls, who headed east, were slower to reach the notice of the literate Mediterranean countries, but they too did well. A group of marauding Celts even attempted to sack the Greek Holy of Holies, the sanctuary of Apollo perched on the precipitous slopes at Delphi in 279 BC. Driven off in part, legend says, by the god himself shaking rocks down the mountains at them, they wandered up to Bulgaria, where vestiges of plaid remains in some of the local folk customs, costumes. Eventually, these eastward-moving Celts fetched up in central Turkey in what is come to be called Galatia, where the Apostle Paul visited later. And then she claims that for nearly a millennium before their expansion, the early Celts had lived in present-day Hungary, Austria, and southern Germany. And basically they were there digging for salt. I think they came in to Europe along with the Scythians and the Cimmerians, actually before all that happened, and that was sort of on their way into Europe. And there was obviously there were people in Britain before then, because we had people in Britain that were mining the tin for the Fertile Crescent. And that again, that's associated with Assyria, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It would make sense. Maybe that's where the Romans got their noses from. Roman nose, you know.
Possibly. And I mean, also, there's one of the Egyptian pharaohs claimed that he had come to the Isles of the West, the Tin Isles, and taught them how to make tin. And that was round about, when was that? It was 3000 BC, just after that. after 3000 BC, probably about 2500 BC. So he claimed that he was there in Britain teaching them how to do the tin. So it makes sense to me that it was the same people that were in Mesopotamia, and some of them went to the west and made their way into Hallstatt and from there into Britain. And at the same time, some of them headed to the east, and they got to this Tarim Basin here, and they also got to India as well. And obviously we talked about the Indus Valley civilization, which was sort of lower down in India rather than up the top area by Tibet, where these ones appeared to be heading. And then later on you get the Scythians, probably about 1000 BC and going up to 600, 500 BC. And the Scythians from the area that we know as Scythia, they spread out to the east, and they spread out to the west as well. And this actual place, this Tarim Basin where they found these bodies, it became one of the important stops on the Silk Road, which didn't really take place until about the time of Christ, I think. And you had the Silk Road that made its way over to China, and there were oases along the way and places where they could stop. And this place here, the Tarim Basin, that was one of the places where there was an oasis and they could stop there. And then once that dried out, people stopped using it, and they stopped using the Silk Road, and we discovered these bodies there. So I don't know if I was going too fast there for you to pick up on.
No, I mean, it's a lot to take in, but it's all interesting.
It's like all of this, I read this stuff and then I try to fit it in with the other information that I know about to try and get a sort of general picture of how everything is going. And this is interesting as well, because it gets very political. In 2007, the Chinese government allowed a National Geographic Society team headed by Spencer Wells to examine the mummy's DNA. Wells was able to extract undegraded DNA from the internal tissues. The scientists extracted enough material to suggest the Tarim Basin was continually inhabited from 2000 BC to 300 BC, and preliminary results indicate the people, rather than having a single origin, originated from Europe, Mesopotamia, the Indus Valley, and other regions yet to be determined. So what is that? Well, that's the three areas that we've determined that we had white civilization in: Europe, Mesopotamia, and the Indus Valley. So this area here and these people here that were in the Tarim Basin, they were connected up with these other civilizations that we've looked at, basically. So these other regions yet to be determined. I'm not quite sure which ones they're talking about there.
Yeah, I mean, when you consider the, how a typical Chinaman looks today, I mean, you can see they're quite pale skinned, and you can see that there would have been potentially some, influence of Indo-European genome. But I wonder what else they, what kind of other hominids they would have likely mixed with.
Well, we'll get into that in a minute. But it's interesting you bring that up, because in Xinjiang, which is the closest main settlement to this area, they do have light haired types with white skin and blue eyes and ginger hair.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that kind of a district of China, or?
Yeah, Xinjiang. It's an area. I think it's quite popular today. Xinjiang. I think it might be where the Uyghurs are. Xinjiang province.
I'll have to look that up.
That might be where you've heard of it. Because they've got lots of different ethnicities there. And it's not the Chinese ethnicity. It's not the Han Chinese. It's another ethnicity that they've got there. That still in the families there, they will have like the light coloured hair and the blue eyes. The same as with the Yazidi tribe. In Afghanistan, they will still have blue eyes and blonde hair that appear every so often. Like you'll get a family and the mother and the father will be very dark, and then the mother will give birth to someone with European looking features. And that's because it's a throwback to the time of Alexander the Great. And when this happens in this area, in Xinjiang, it's a throwback to this time when these Indo-Aryans were there, or Indo-Europeans. Whichever you prefer to call them by.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like you get the same in Afghanistan. We mentioned that a few weeks ago, didn't we?
Yeah. But as you were just saying then, well, what about the Chinese types? The Chinese or the Mongolian types appear 1,500 years later. Chinese historian Ji Jinlang says China supported and admired research by foreign experts into the mummies. However, within China, a small group of ethnic separatists have taken advantage of this opportunity to stir up trouble and are acting like buffoons. Some of them have even styled themselves the descendants of these ancient white people with the aim of dividing the motherland, but these perverse acts will not succeed. Berber addresses these claims by noting that the Lulan beauty is scarcely closer to Turkic in her anthropological type than she is to Han Chinese. The body and facial forms associated with Turks and Mongols began to appear in the Tarim cemeteries only in the first millennium BC, 1500 years after this woman lived. Due to the fear of fueling separatist currents, the Xinjiang Museum, regardless of dating, displays all their mummies, both Tarim and Han, together. So what they're saying there is that the Mongolian type that appeared there 1,500 years later is the Han Chinese type. And the type that was there 1,500 years before that, they were white, basically.
And so as they are today, would be somewhere in the middle, the typical Chinaman.
Yeah. Yeah, they probably still look fairly similar to these Han Chinese. But I was also reading that the Chinese didn't go there until the people from Turkestan had gone there first, or Turkmenistan. So, I mean, they were probably, well, they would have definitely been a lot whiter looking back then than they are today. But they may have been white as well originally back then. But the Chinese didn't come there till later.
Right. There's a distinction between Turkic and Turkish, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
Just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we're not talking about the modern day Turks. Turkey didn't appear as a country until, I don't know, after the First World War, I think it was, with Ataturk. So it was named after
Turkic
this one man.
Is more to do with a cultural label or?
Yeah, it's where you get the name Turkmenistan from and Turkestan. It was I think it was a type similar to the Siberian Mongolian herdsman type.
Okay, but the early Mongols were said to be typically white, right?
This is another issue. If you're talking about Genghis Khan, it looks like the Golden Horde, he was depicted at the time when he was alive as being white. And Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson has done research into this, and he says it looks like the people that he was with were actually Megalos, and they were one of the Scythian tribes, because you had a massive number of these Scythian tribes and these Scythian peoples that were sort of outside of Christendom, and they were still living in that area where the Scythians came into Europe from. There were still people that were living in that area that were still white, and they became these tribes that the great Khan came from when they came into Europe. And more evidence to add to that is that in China, they never talked about the wonderful time that they conquered Europe and what a great how their wonderful ancestors managed to take over half of Europe. It was never a part of their history, because they knew that it wasn't part of Chinese history. And if you look at Russian DNA today, there's no evidence of them ever being taken over by the Chinese, because there's no Chinese DNA mixed in with the Russian DNA. So the people that actually came in there under Genghis Khan, they were mainly white people. I mean, there may have been some others in there, but they were white. And if you look up the pictures of Genghis Khan, and you look up the pictures of his sons as well, and I mean, this was in 1200, so you're talking original source documents here, and they picture them all as being white. There's a Russian researcher who has collected all the images of them that he can find, all the way going, and the line as well, going from Genghis Khan all the way down through his sons, and he shows quite conclusively that they were all white. I mean, otherwise somebody would have said at the time, well, hang on a minute, you know, he didn't look like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of modern images, though, tend to depict Genghis Khan and a lot of them, even the Huns, for example, as with Mongolian features. And I think that's obviously just because of, you know, the typical association with modern day phenotypes.
Yeah, that's a modern thing. That's only in the last 100 years has Genghis Khan ever been depicted as Chinese. And because of it, in Mongolia, they put a great big statue up of him because they were told that, you know, he was one of their ancestors. Yeah, it's quite bizarre, really. Yeah, we've got some stuff at Radio Albion on it as well, actually. I think if people look up Genghis Khan, they'll find some podcasts that we've actually done on it, because I'm just trying to go on memory here. But Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson has done like a whole episode on the Orthodox Nationalist looking into this. So his work is probably the best one to look to for that. And talking of the Scythians, the Saka, we'll talk a little bit about them. Mallory and Mayer in 2000 proposed the movement of at least two Caucasian physical types into the Tarim Basin. The authors associate these types with the Tocharian and the Iranian Saka branches of the Indo-European language family, respectively. The Saka were not really known that far back, though. They were the Scythian tribe that Buddha actually came from. And there is evidence to show that the Saka tribe of Scythians later became known as the Saxons, with Germany still being known as Scythia because of this right up until the 10th century AD by British historians. And that's quite interesting, because the modern people will look at that and they'll say, oh, what idiots these British historians were. They didn't know where Scythia is. Scythia is up near Iran. Why did they say that it was in Germany? What idiots. Well, they said that Scythia was Germany because they knew the Germans as the Scythians. They knew that this group of people called the Scythians had made their way into Europe, and the Romans referred to them as the Germani, the genuine Scythians, because actually in the country of Scythia, other tribes had moved in there. So the genuine Scythians, the white ones, that were 100% white, had moved into Europe, and they were known as Germani, meaning genuine. And the British wrote down that Scythia was in Germany because that's where the Scythians were, and that the Scythians became known as the Saxons, just by the way that language changes. And these tribes that moved into Scythia eventually ended up becoming the tribes that came in with Genghis Khan. And I say that some of them may not have been white. Genghis Khan was white, and there were whites amongst them, but by that time you also had mixed people in there as well. Is that clear?
Would you say that they would have blended in with the current German population then?
Well,
of Europe.
You just had a horde that came in, didn't you, with Genghis Khan. You would have had like hangers-on and all sorts, basically, that came in with him. There isn't any traces of anything other than white in Russia from these tribes that came in, these megalos. But the Roman historians needed to differentiate between who was a genuine Scythian and who wasn't. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of the name of the tribe that actually moved into Scythia. It's somewhere in the back of my mind, but I can't quite place my finger on it. It's not the Massageti. Yeah. And they used to wear armor which looked like leaves, as if they were all dressed in leaves, and their horses as well had this strange armor on them. It's annoying that I can't remember the name of them. But they moved in there after the Scythians left the area that was Scythia. But the Scythians also went to the east as well as into the west, into Europe. And this particular tribe, the Saka, which Mallory and May are talking about, Buddha was a member of their tribe. And they described them as being part of the Iranian branch of the Saka, of the Scythians. Okay. Because, I mean, they were basically the area that we know because we're told about it on the Behistun Rock. And it was just up above Assyria. So it was the west of Persia, the west of Iran today, basically. But looking into this, because of this, what I was just saying there about the Scythians becoming Saxons, there's a book which I mentioned in an earlier episode, and I couldn't remember the name of it, and I found this book last week. It's actually called The Lost Tribes and the Saxons of the East and of the West, with New Views of Buddhism and Translations of Rock Records in India, by George Moore, MD, 1803 to 1880. And you can actually find that on archive.org. And I found some quotes from that which talks about this. And this is obviously what people knew of their history back in 1880. People understood that we came from the Scythians.
I think, I think there was a resurgence starting from them, wasn't there? I mean, you don't know if a lot of books like this would have influenced the Mormons, because from their understanding, they connect a lot of the Europeans to some of the tribes, don't they?
I couldn't tell you
if they were influenced to a certain extent.
I think they probably were, but I couldn't tell you for certain the details of Mormon beliefs. I think they got it from two magic plates or something, which had all this stuff on it, which sort of tends to discredit the historians, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, definitely. But I think they probably saw it as something kind of being topical. And then, like most kind of cults, they'll take certain truths or things which have some weight to it, and then they'll pack it in with their own, kind of either delusions or lies or whatever it is. And a lot of people tend to swallow it whole, you know?
Yeah. It does show that that sort of thing was popular at the time. And that was the sort of thing that white people were interested in. Otherwise, it wouldn't have taken off. As I say, I found some quotes from this book which talks about this. Turner, in his History of the Anglo-Saxons, says, "The Saxons were a Gothic or Scythian tribe, and of the various Scythian nations which have been recorded, the Sacae or Sacas are the people from whom the descent of the Saxons may be inferred with the least violation of probability. Sacasuna, or the sons of the Sacae, abbreviated into Saxon, which is the same sound as Saxon, seems a reasonable etymology of the word Saxon. The Sacae, who in Latin are called Sacae, were the most important branch of the Scythian nation. They were so celebrated that, as already observed, the Persians called all the Scythians by the name of Sacae, and Pliny, who mentions this, remarks that they were among the most distinguished people of Scythia. Strabo places them eastwards of the Caspian and states them to have made many incursions on the Cimmerians and Treves, both far and near. They seized Bactriana and the most fertile part of Armenia, which from them derived the name Sacacina. They defeated Cyrus the Great, and they reached the Cappadoces on the Euxine. This important fact of a part of Armenia having been named Sacacina is mentioned by Strabo in another place. This seems to give an early geographical locality to our primeval ancestors and to account for the Persian words which occur in the Saxon language, as they must have come into Armenia from the northern regions of Persia. That some of the divisions, at least, of the people were called Sacasuna is obvious from Pliny, for he says that the Sacae who settled in Armenia, implying that they had come from another country, were named Sacasani, which is but Sacasuni, spelt by a person unacquainted with the meaning of the combined words. And the name Sacacina, which they gave to the part of Armenia they occupied, is nearly the same sound as Saxonia. It is also important to remark that Ptolemy mentions a Scythian people sprung from the Sacae by the name of Saxones. If the Sacae who reached Armenia were called Sacassani, they may have traversed Europe with the same appellation, which, being pronounced by the Romans from them and then reduced to writing from their pronunciation, would have been spelt with an X instead of the KS, and thus Saxones or Saxons would not be a greater deviation from Sacassani or Sacassana than we find between French, Francois, Frankie, and their Greek name Fraggy, or between Spain, Espana, and Hispania. Sacassani, being the name of this people in Armenia, is itself a clue to their origin, for the word would mean, in Hebrew, not sons of Sac, but Sacs that had altered their abode or their character. The Persians of old distinguished the Sakae into those of Sakae Hamavirga, Amerigian, and those of Sakae Tigra Kuda. That is to say, the tribes seated on the confines of India and those scattered throughout the Persian Empire. The name Sakae was applied to them first as simply the tribes, perhaps adopted from themselves, but ultimately it came to signify bowmen because they, like the Ephraimites and the English, were so famous for the use of the bow. And I'll just pause there because he's pointing out that you had a group of these Scythians that made their way to India, and they would have made their way to India passing through the Tarim Basin, and you had another group of these Scythians that made their way into Europe and then became known as the Saxons. As I'm paused here, do you want to add anything to that or bring anything up, Patriarch?
I've kind of heard that the Saxons were connected to the Sakae, so I pretty much did have an understanding, and they came from Assyria, and that was as a result of the after the collapse of the Assyrian Empire, which is when they branched off from the Scythians. I know the Saxon people as a whole, the Saxon culture has left quite a few different fingerprints really across various parts of Europe. Even in Romania, there's a lot of typical Saxon looking houses in parts of Romania and around there.
Of course, and then you also get people who say, "Oh, yes, but the Germans, they were there in Germany for much longer than that." Yes, but how many of them were actually there? And they were white people, the same as this was white people. So you then had a much larger group of them that came in later on. You had, as Dr. E. Michael Jones says, the Germans that were actually in Germany, they were just running around hunting pigs. They weren't doing much. They didn't have a civilization there. There weren't that many of them there. It wasn't till the Scythians came in that they had a large enough group there, and then they went out and conquered Rome. And they're going to be able to conquer Rome because they're the same people that conquered Persia and defeated Cyrus and made their way to India. Mm. And this author here is talking about this because he's talking about their link to Buddhism, because it was a Scythian prince that became the first Buddha from this tribe, the Sakae. Now, that's his reason for writing this book, basically. And these quotes that I've got here, they just tie in with what we're talking about now. Continuing, the country called Sakae is one of those which were subject to Darius. That's Darius the Great, I think, the Persian king. According to Norris's interpretation of the Scythic Behistun rock inscription, and we've mentioned that before, that's the rock that's in Iran, which has got the depiction of the captured in captivity, the tribes in captivity. There's 12 of them. It's the tribes of Israel, basically, in captivity to Darius, and he wrote it up on this rock there that he had these tribes. And it was written in three different languages, and in one language it calls them Scythians, in another language it calls them Cimmerians, and in the other language it calls them Habiru. And it wasn't three different peoples, it was one people, and they were called by those different names in those different languages. And when the Cimmerians, some of them left and they kept that name Comri and became the Cimmerians, and others left and they were still called the Scythians. And the Scythians ended up fighting against the Cimmerians in the same way that the British ended up fighting against Germany last year. So, it's no surprise to see that these groups ended up fighting amongst themselves and ended up being given different names. And as you go on through history, the language changes and customs change and all the rest of it, and they become distinct peoples, whereas originally they were just one people.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think we're not so far far back. We're kind of cut from the same cloth.
Yeah.
And that obviously is why it doesn't really faze me when to think that Britain, for example, has been kind of invaded and essentially is a nation made up of a branch of different cultures, essentially. But, you know, I think we mentioned even last week that, you know, it wasn't that far off in the past that we, you know, were one kind of tribe anyway. So it doesn't really matter too much. We're just kind of reuniting again, essentially.
Well, that's what was really happening with America. I mean, America would have been a new white nation, basically, if it continued with the immigration policy it had in the 1900s. It would have been like another European nationality, basically. The types that were there, which were mainly Nordic types, they would have interbred with the very best of our people, because it was all the pioneering types that managed to make their way over there and that didn't end up dying out. And they would have been a really strong Nordic nation over there in the New World. But instead, they changed their immigration policy, and now it's a multicultural country. And the Americans don't have a distinct ethnic type. I you know, like when you look at the Scandinavians and you think tall and blonde, you look at the Scots and you think, you know, red haired and blue eyes, or, you know, you look at the south of Europe and you think, well, sort of shorter people with sort of smaller skulls. And the Americans would have been a unique type like that. You know, I can think of the Latvians and the Lithuanians with their pointed noses. You know, they've got a distinct look to them. The English have a distinct look to them. And the Americans would have ended up with a distinct look to them if they hadn't changed their immigration policy.
Immigration with regards to which types of people, you mean?
Well, they brought they started off with Russian Jews and Eastern Jews that they brought in, and then they opened up to everybody. And now they've got Somalians, Pakistanis, Thai, Chinese. Well, they actually opened up to the Chinese, I think, around about the same time as the Eastern Jews. And before that, I mean, it was difficult to get in there if you were Italian or Irish, even. It was mainly English and Germans that were in America originally, and the Irish that were brought over there were enslaved, basically. They were indentured servants, and a lot of the Scots from the Highlands were sent over there as indentured servants as well, so they were in the same situation as the black African slaves were when they were brought over there at first. And then they changed the immigration policy, and they allowed Irish to immigrate properly, and Italians. And then they allowed Russian Jews to emigrate as well, and Chinese. There's racial books written in the 1920s that are very concerned about the Chinese coming into America, and they were working for cheaper than the American whites. So that was a concern back then. The Chinese haven't really turned out to be that much of a problem in America, when you think about it.
No, generally there are people that keep themselves to themselves, and, you know, other than their cultural tastes for certain animals, I quite like the Chinese, to be honest. I think they're hardworking people, and you know, generally they've got a lot to them.
Very patriotic. Very patriotic, the Chinese. And getting back here to these quotes here, and talking about the country, well, it is now Iran, that has the Behistun Rock. The locality of this country is not, or the locality of the country where the Scythians were, rather, is not indicated except by its connection in this inscription. And from that, we gather that it was on the borders of Media to the northeast, which is the known seat of some of the Sakae after the Scythian invasion of Armenia and Assyria. Our Anglo-Saxon historian Turner points out the probable manner in which this bold and enterprising people were impelled westwards until settled in our own land. We will not follow him, but from another source we are interested to learn that the white island in the west, England, was in India denominated Sakana, from the Sakas, or Saks, who conquered that island and settled there at a very early period, as we find from the fact being mentioned in the Puranas, named Varada and Matsya, and that they're Hindu religious texts, the Puranas. Captain Wilford has shown from these piranhas that the British Isles are to be understood by Sachem, as well as certain adjacent parts of the continent such as Saxony, that these Sakas or Saks were of a race identical with those that entered northwestern India and overran a great part of Asia is either implied or expressed by all historians who mention them, whether in the East or the West. The fact then seems pretty well established that the Saxon race sprung from the East and that these have opposed and superseded the dominion of old Rome wherever they have reached in the West. The spreadings and doings of the Saxon race constitute the chief parts of modern history. There is no land where they are not, and no people that has not been stirred up by them. They now take the Bible with them wherever they go, and found their commerce with the wide world upon the rights and liberties which Christianity has taught them to value as their lives. The fact that we have 600 or 700 words in our language of Persian origin agrees with our own origin being amongst the Persians, but not of them. Hebrew roots, too, are not a few amongst our homeliest words. If we are related to the Sake, their stirring, restless, conquering spirit is in keeping with that of our forefathers, ever famous for the bow and the battle axe. A glance at the ancient Sakas in the East will show the likeness. They had detached themselves from Persia before Alexander's invasion. Independently, they fought as allies of Darius at Arbela. They contended with Alexander's army without dishonour. A century later, they established their rule from the Aral Lake to the mouths of the Indus. They then invaded central India, but then fell under the dominion of the Parthians, probably of the same race, and finally were absorbed in the kingdom of the Sassanidae, also Saxon, pretty much as the Saxons of England have become blended with the Normans, or the Northmen, and the Danes, who are also traceable to the same Saxon source. So that's some really fascinating stuff there, tying it all in to the Saxons.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this isn't going to be taught in your mainstream schools, is it? I mean, I don't think even the most mainstream subjects now are taught in most schools to our children, let alone kind of this line of history, which has totally been, buried.
Well, they want to try and portray us as cavemen living in caves and living like savages rather than, you know, defeating Rome and making it all the way over to India and fighting with not getting dishonor with Alexander the Great. I mean, it is a glorious history when you look at the history of the white race, basically, and everywhere that we've been and everything that's gone on. And it does help you to sort of place yourself and not to get too upset about what's going on around us. You think, well, it has all happened before. And, you know, we managed to make our way through it back then. And as we were hearing then about them fighting amongst themselves and the Cimmerians fighting against the Scythians, and then you don't feel too bad that we British went to war against the Germans. You know, it's like we can't help ourselves, basically. Can't help ourselves doing these things.
It's been one of our it's been something which has helped us to expand and kind of spread around the world. But at the same time, it's been something to our detriment as well, you know, in terms of just killing ourselves. And I mean, if we didn't have half of the brother wars that we had, I don't think we'd be at a point now where we're, you know, about 10% of the world population.
Yeah, greed comes into it. I think in the past, we were probably more like 80 or 90% of the world's population. We're only such a small minority of the population now because we shared all our technology with these other races, so that instead of dying off at an early age when they were infants, they end up growing to adulthood. And if you look at Africa, some parts of Africa, 60% of the population are under the age of 30. 60%. Wow. So they've literally doubled in the last 30 years in their population size. And that's because we've given them our medicine and we've given them our technology. So if you think they now make up such a large portion of the demographics of the world, they certainly didn't 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago.
But you know, I mean, that's the natural cycle of that would be that if whites die out, then unless they can sustain the same level of medicine and technology, they'll inevitably die out as well at the same rate.
Well, that's the issue, and that's what these old I don't know what you would call them, racial scientists, racial authors in the 1900s. That's what they were pointing out. They were saying, look, this isn't to anybody's benefit to have multiculturalism. If whites end up getting blended out, then these other races are going to really suffer. And they should understand that. And they should not want that to happen because of the way that we help them. And that's what they were pointing out. And that comes through in all of it, that this concern. We've always been concerned about these other peoples. We've always been a charitable people, and we've always wanted the best for the other peoples in the world. And it's really only us that do that. That's why it's so unjust the way that we're characterized today as being the bad guys and the oppressors.
Yeah. There was a guy called, I forget his name, but he's a Carla. He's a mixed race guy, and obviously he panders to, you know, the black genes in him. And he made a comment about how it was a kind of a catchphrase of the whites back then. They called it the white man's burden, and which is, you know, probably true. But the fact that the white people would feel it as a burden to, you know, look after and help to elevate other cultures is actually a virtuous thing.
Yeah, well, it can be looked upon as a burden, but we're capable of carrying that burden. I mean, that's the point of it. Yes, it is a burden, but we are capable of carrying that burden. We're the only ones that are. I mean, there's a cartoon which illustrates that. And it's got the British guy and it's got an American guy, Uncle Sam and John Bull, and they're both carrying baskets. And in the back of the baskets, they've got the natives of India and the natives of South America, and they're sort of carrying them up this hill to civilization. And you know, maybe that's for some people would say, well, that's a cruel way to look at it. But that's what we were trying to do. We were trying to bring these other peoples to civilization. We were like, look, we've got a great way to live here. We've worked out a good way to live. We've got all this technology. We've done away with lots of diseases. And we'd like to share that with you so that you can manage your own countries. And that's essentially what the British Empire was. And once we thought that these people were up to a standard where they could manage the infrastructure for themselves, it was handed over to them. Mm. But when
apart
you get
from what they call the Native Americans, apparently they died out from the diseases that
they went to war against us. They went to war against us, and they lost basically. But we honoured them when they lost. We didn't turn them into slaves. We named our tanks after them, our helicopters after them, because they were such brave fighters, and we gave them land and said, "Well, you can live on this land, and you can keep your own laws." It's absolutely unheard of in history to do that to a vanquished foe. I mean, that just shows you how magnanimous we were, what good people we were. And we still are good people. I think we're going to have to leave that there for now, though, Patriarch. We'll get into Buddha next week. So thank you very much for coming on today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.